I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to minute 61 of season 6 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me this week, I have special guests. For anyone who knows me and my show, you know, most of the time I use the same guests every time, but just because, you know, I enjoy the conversations with them. But this time I went because we're dealing with a classic movie, and I decided that I'm going to try and find some people who have more of a background dealing specifically with classic movies. And I came across a podcast. We have this week two of the trio of hosts from the old Movie Time Machine. We have Justin and Caroline to join us this week. So welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, Rob. Thanks. Thank you so much for having us. We're very excited and feeling very honored to be welcome into the Movie Rob family at this point.
I mean, exactly.
It's very special for us. I know it's rare elite company, and I'm just pleased to be a part of it.
Well, I'm glad that you guys were able to find the time to join in and give us the perspective of a minute-by-minute look at It's a Wonderful Life from people who, I'm assuming, have you guys ever encountered a minute-by-minute podcast before?
I'm pretty familiar with it from Star Wars Minute.
So okay. Everyone's familiar from Alex and Pete. There's no question about that. But, you know that there are hundreds of others?
Oh, yeah. Yes. I've checked them out. I think I did one for Hocus Pocus of some years back that I remember listening to. That was very entertaining. But, yeah, it's a fun time.
Okay, but this is the first time you're part of one. You're in it.
Yes.
There you go.
Correct.
There you go. All right. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time to join us for this. So minute 61 begins with George acting quite confused and ends with George showing up at a house with a little sign in front of him that says bridal suite.
Yeah, how do we feel about this house, you guys? I mean, this was a bold move by Mary, I feel like. Just going ahead and getting this house. I think it's a smart, shrewd move on her part to, you know, secure some property for their future family and everything. I will say that, you know, the house, if we were going to list this house, it's a fixer-upper, right? Like, it definitely needs some work.
I think that would be fixer-upper.
Yes, yes. But because
there might be some ghosts.
Well, it's definitely haunted, right?
Right, it's got to be.
So haunted.
Yes. Yeah,
but I would say this is a house that probably has good bones, right? We would say that, like, you could strip it down and start again pretty easily, I think.
I would say it's probably going to be pretty solidly built, because it does look like it's a late 1800s style, although albeit a movie set, which also made me wonder, is it also the same house in The Ghost and Mr. Chicken? Is it, you know, have we seen this house before?
Right.
Potentially. But, you know, it's got the nice turret. And it has
well, again, do you guys know what year this scene is taking place?
Okay. So.
Oh, mathematically.
We start in what? 1919. Is that right? Is that where the 1919 was, starts?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Then this is 12 years later or something like that, somewhere around
this is 13 years later. This is around 1933.
Okay.
Basically the run on the bank, and which just took place, you know, 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. or actually 2 weeks ago and last week, that more or less takes place in somewhere at the end of 1932, 1933, maybe 1934. It's very unclear, because I mean, we know that Harry came back in 1932. And right. so when George was at Mary's house, that was 1932. Long it took for them to continue dating until they got married, because obviously this is the day of their marriage. We don't know. It could be just a few months. It could be a year later. So it's somewhere in between 1932 and 1934. That's my guess. Okay.
So Depression era.
Yes, Depression era. Mm-hmm. No, because you mentioned the fact that this is a late 1800s Victorian house, which means that, I mean, it seems like it's a house that's a little more than 30 years old.
Probably. You
know? Yeah, definitely. But it's so strange that it seems to be in a very nice neighborhood. I mean, there are neighbors. It's not like a blighted area or anything like
that. Well, there are neighbors. So there's one neighbor that we know of that, you know, is a little upset that youth is wasted on the young.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Right. He's jealous of their love. Well, yes. Let's just put it out there. Yes.
Of course.
He wishes he had his own Mary, of course. But it's strange that this house would just kind of sit there, especially when you got old man Potter, who's looking for any kind of, you know, real estate investment, any kind of way to get some more bang out of his buck, just the property value alone. I feel like everybody's missing an opportunity here, but Mary saw it.
Correct.
Yeah, she's I think we know who wears the pants in this relationship and who's deciding when and whom she's marrying, and that's Mary. Mm-hmm. And so she's also going to make some of the big financial decisions, like getting a house.
All right, we are doing this. It's done.
Okay, but I think part of it is that, you know, George is busy with the building and loan. That's taking up all his time. He's got no time for anything else. But he's also oblivious to so many things around him. I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago, that, you know, every time that Mary showed an interest in George, he wasn't catching on. You know, he's a dreamer. You know, he's someone who likes to read about things but doesn't know how to experience them, I guess you can say. And that's more or less the way that I would refer to this here. So he wasn't thinking about, okay, where are they going to live? Because you also have to take into consideration, they were on their way out of town.
Yes.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
So
I felt so bad for this guy. I mean, every time he's just at the outskirts of town, he gets pulled back in.
That's right.
He just never seemed to escape the vacuum of Bedford Falls.
That's right. So
I would also say that Mary kind of ends up being the conduit for a number of things that hold him in town, like the big old house that they're going to fix up that we have now arrived at, and eventually, you know, the kids that come along.
Correct. But we don't see at any point around now that George is still trying to get out. You know, once he realized that Harry is not going to be taking over, he realizes he's stuck there. You know, so again, we talked about the timeline. This is maybe a few months later or maybe a year or two later, whatever it is, but he's still stuck there. And we don't see him seeking a way to get out.
No, he seems very committed to this idea that, okay, I'm going to be doing this, you know, for the foreseeable future. And it's a good character note, I think, for him. I mean, it really reinforces what a solid guy he is. You know, somebody who is committed to preserving the family business and, you know, doing right by the people he's grown up with and everything. So
correct.
It's very interesting. It makes him more heroic in his own way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now I want to stop us here because we sort of jumped a little bit ahead. Let's move back a little bit because before we get to the house, you know, we still have the few seconds. There's like 10 seconds of the beginning of this minute that is dealing with George still in the building and loan. So let's jump back in.
Yes.
Your podcast has a great name because it's a time machine. So let's go back in time a few seconds and we'll get to the beginning of the minute where basically George is on the phone. He had gotten a phone call. He asked his cousin Tilly to get Mrs. Bailey on the line, get his wife on the line. And then she says, Mrs. Bailey's on the line, not realizing at first that Mrs. Bailey is actually Mary, his wife, and not his mother. Mm-hmm. And we only hear George's side of the conversation, but he goes, what? Come home? What home? 320 Sycamore? Well, what? Whose home is that? And then he goes, oh, the Waldorf Hotel, huh? And that's the entire conversation that we hear here. So, I mean, some of the things that he says here are very interesting. You know, like, for instance, the fact that he first starts talking about Sycamore Road. You'd think that, you know, Bedford Falls isn't that big. If he's told right. you got to go to Sycamore Road, he should know more or less where that is. You know, you'd think that he might not know it's this specific house, but he'll say to himself, okay, it's somewhere in between the high school and my house, or Mary's house, mm-hmm. whichever it could be.
Right.
Do either of you know where the term Sycamore comes from? I mean, I'm the assuming tree? You both know it's a tree. Yes. But where's yeah. the, what's the etymology of the term Sycamore?
I mean, no it's idea. Like my first impression, I would think that maybe it's some kind of Native American tribe related name or something like that. But that's just a guess.
That's what I would have thought also. I looked it up mm-hmm. and it's actually from ancient Greek, meaning it's really? A fig mulberry. And, you know, they just decided to use that. Maybe it probably does have some connection to Native Americans, because that's what I would think of. But mm-hmm. I think it's more like Sequoia you think of from that, but I'm not sure.
Right, you know. Right. Yeah. And this is, I just wanted to double, like Bedford Falls, this is upstate New York, right?
We're supposed to yes.
That's what inspired by.
We're supposed to understand that it's upstate New York because they mention, you know, Rochester and mm-hmm. Buffalo. Right. The song Buffalo Girls. It was a song that they would change the name of or the words in the song depending on where you were geographically. You know, so it was Buffalo Gals gotcha. Because they were closer to Buffalo. And then you have Detroit Gals near Detroit. And I think there was Dallas. I don't remember all of the different towns or cities that were used at the time. But that's also another indication of how close we are to Buffalo and Rochester. Because Rochester is where Sam wants to build the plant.
Right.
Yes.
So we know that it's somewhere in the area, you know, stuff like that. So, yes.
Gotcha.
And so then he mentions the Waldorf Hotel. So mm-hmm. are you familiar with the Waldorf Hotel?
Yes, the Waldorf Astoria yeah. in New York on the east side.
That is correct. Do you know the history of it?
No, but I'd love to hear it. Carolyn might actually.
I might know some of it, but you've probably already researched it. But I have been in the Waldorf many times. If I'm not mistaken, it's also been used in quite a few movies.
Yes, that is correct. But yes. Did you know that there was the original Waldorf Astoria that was torn down in 1929? And then they had a new one that was built mm-hmm. after that. So the original one that it could be, and now George could be referring to either of them. You know, because again, the big one was from the original one was from 1897 to 1929. It was built in 1893. It was expanded in 1897, and they actually built two hotels side by side on Fifth Avenue in New York.
Okay, two hotels.
Yes, and then they were raised in order to build the Empire State Building. Empire State Building is on the exact spot of where the original Waldorf Astoria was. So then the Waldorf Astoria was built by a millionaire whose name was William Waldorf Astor.
Yes.
Probably of Astor Place.
That's right.
Probably
he originally had a mansion there. And then they raised the mansion and then built the dual hotels that were there that you know stood for almost, over 30 years, these two hotels. Astor, as anyone who's seen Titanic knows, is also, you know, it was one of the richest families in America in the mm-hmm. late 19th century, early 20th century. You know, you had John Jacob Astor who died on the Titanic. You know, they discussed yes. him.
Right.
He was discussed in the movie.
Do we know how their fortune was built? I mean, is it just old hotel money or did they come from timber or smelting or something like that?
Oh, we know these things.
Okay.
Railroads? Shipping?
It's got to be one of those. I do feel like this was a time in the United States where building projects like Empire State Building or a big old hotel would be national news. Like that's something that people would be very excited about. Like, oh, they're building a new huge hotel in the city.
Correct.
Definitely.
This is before television, obviously. So
well, they had nothing better to do.
The kicks are hard to find. Yeah, right.
Yeah. So the Astor family was they were involved in business and politics in the U.S. and in England during the 19th and 20th centuries. The first Astor to come up in history that's known was in the 18th century. It was John Jacob Astor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came over from Germany in the late 18th century. And I mean, he had there are a whole bunch of John Jacob Astors. I don't even know how many there are at this point. So, yeah, you had John Jacob Astor III died in 1890. And he was actually William Waldorf Astor's father.
Okay. Family of entrepreneurs.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And the Waldorf, now, is this the home base of the Waldorf salad? All of you Fawlty Towers fans out there, this is where the Waldorf salad was put together?
I'm pretty sure.
I believe so. I believe I've heard that also. I didn't look up the Waldorf salad.
I can give you a really fun. So I live in Virginia, and there is a famous old Virginia family named the Langhorns, and they had four daughters. And one of the daughters married an Astor and then became like the first woman seated in Parliament.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So Nancy Astor, formerly Langhorne.
Right. So the one who died on the Titanic was John Jacob Astor IV.
Yes. Yeah. This was, I'm guessing this is sort of a Astor offshoot, whatever ones went to England after making their money in the United States.
Well, actually, Waldorf was one of the first ones was one of them who went to England. He actually became very prominent in England also. Not just in America at the time.
Yeah.
He became a Viscount.
Waldorf.
He was the first Viscount.
Waldorf Astor, I think, was her second husband, Nancy Langhorne's second husband.
Yeah, it could be. He moved to England in 1891. I guess that's why he basically raised his property and built a hotel there, because he wasn't going to be living in that mansion anymore. Gotcha. Moved to England. Yeah. And then ended up becoming a baron and then became a Viscount in 1917 for his contributions to the war charities. So then the second Waldorf Astoria that was built on Park Avenue between 49th and 50th Streets. And they actually completed it in 1931. So again, this is, we're talking about 1932. 1933, 1934, somewhere around there. So, it makes me wonder which of them George is referring to. You know, my assumption is he's referring to the first one because he probably read about it and he wouldn't necessarily have read about any of the new ones, the new stuff yet. Mm-hmm. That would be my assumption.
Yeah, it could be.
I could be wrong.
Could be.
You know, it's what we would call an educated guess. You know, it might be wrong. But it's educated. So why not?
I do think it's a bold move to invest in building a couple of huge hotels in the middle of the Depression. That's an interesting decision, but people have to have a place to sleep, I guess, when they're visiting.
That's true. That's true. But again, he was, was it still him? I'm trying to think if it was still him or maybe it was one of his kids at that point that dealt with it. Because he passed away in 1919, William Waldorf Astor. So it's whoever was taking control of, the hotel at that point decided to continue doing it. Maybe, maybe there was, it was a conglomerate at that point, or maybe it was a, I don't know, maybe they had a board of Astors, that decided to do it.
Yeah, could be.
Well, yeah.
No idea. Okay, so then we get another one of these great scene swipes that they do in this movie, and we see George, walking in the rain, going, which shows he doesn't have a car yet. He's still dealing with the fact that he just got rid of $2,000 earlier that day.
Right.
Yeah.
I have to say, I wanted to point out the rain because it's really good movie rain, I feel like. This movie really does precipitation very well. I have to confess, this movie has been a real cultural blind spot for me. I had not seen it before you invited us onto your show.
Seriously?
So, yeah, I'm
shocked. Oh, wow.
It's one of these. It's a great shame that I have carried with me that has now been lifted off my shoulders.
Well, I'm glad that I was part of that. You know, you're not my first guest who hasn't seen it before. But it just shocks me that you hadn't seen it. That's what it comes down to.
Yeah. It's one of those things I was thinking about it, like, why would I have not seen it? Because we didn't grow up watching it. I know Carolyn has a different journey with this movie than I do, but it wasn't one of the standards that you would put on every year. It's always on television, but it's not one that we made a point of going out of our way to watch. So I was thinking, I'm a bit embarrassed because I really love the Dickens Christmas Carol story. I love every version of it. If it's animated, Muppets, the one from the 50s, the one from the 70s, I've seen them all and they're all great. And I love, especially as will eventually happen in this story, the sort of alternate timeline and being taken and shown what has been or what could be, that kind of thing. So I feel like those two really work hand in hand. So I was really pleased to see that, you know, this is sort of an offshoot of that concept a little bit.
Interesting.
Right off the bat, watching this, I couldn't help but notice the snow. This is some of the best movie snow I have ever seen. Looks legit. It looks very serious. It's hardy snow, big flakes. I don't question the reality of it. And it just does a very good job. I don't know if you've already talked about it, but it turns out that this is Academy Award-winning snow. This snow was apparently developed through a new process. Before, they would use cornflakes that were painted white. And Frank Capra, who has a background in chemistry, was not satisfied with this. And so they had to develop a new chemical formula with soap flakes that would make it look more realistic and give them the volume that they needed for it. And through this process, the technical team, I guess, won an Oscar for this, for making great movie snow. And so that just kind of, so they're doing snow really well, top marks there. And then the rain in the scene, as the viewer, I feel that rain. It is very gloomy and depressing, heavy, looks chilly. Like I feel the rain. So great job all around there, I think.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. Now, I mean, I find it really interesting that George is standing there in front of the building, you know, in front of this house, looking around, trying to figure out what's really going on here. Now, if we jump back in time a little bit and think when he was there, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago with Mary, when they were throwing the rocks, you know, they were a lot further away if they were walking on the street.
Yeah, they were.
I think they were across the street.
You think they were like on the other side of the street, but it was still, it still looks a lot closer here than it did then.
Yes. And maybe that is by design, you know, because now they are going to soon living in this house full time. It is part of their immediate presence, whereas in that previous scene, it is a more remote possibility for them.
Yeah, but it looked further away from the road. That's my point. Back then, it looked further away from the road.
Oh, yeah.
And now he's right there. Did you notice some of the, I guess you can call it junk, that's on the sides as he's walking into, walking towards the front of the door?
Nothing specific that I remember. What do you have listed there? I mean, there's stuff all over the
place. It looks to me like there's a lawn jockey there.
Really? Oh, okay.
You know, on the left-hand side, if you're looking at second 18, okay, as he's walking by, you see what looks like a figurine that could very well be like a lawn jockey, which is just really funny. Okay. Or it's like some little kid that's just stuck there. I don't know. It's one or the other.
Probably a lawn jockey.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably. Do either of you know the history of lawn jockeys?
I do not.
I mean, I know some history, and it also depends on the neighborhood you live in and how you have them painted, obviously, because in a horsey area and an equestrian area, they're a big lawn ornament.
Okay.
Popular.
Yeah.
And do you know why? Do you know why they had them there when people had a lot of horses?
Yes, because they would tie up the horses.
That's right. It was a hitching post. Yes. Very good. Very good.
Yes. Now they have them like holding a lantern.
Correct.
So yes.
Yeah. So there are a whole bunch of different reasons used as to how they first came into being. And that some of them say that they were based on a servant of George Washington, who was working in the Continental Army. Who the boy's name was Jocko Graves. That apparently he was left behind and didn't cross the Delaware with them, and then he ended up dying while he was tending to the horses. And he was frozen with a lantern in his hand.
Do we know why he was left behind?
They claim that it was too dangerous for him to cross. I don't know what that means.
That's... yeah, what is that?
That's it's the middle of winter. Yeah, we're all freezing our butts off, but you know, we're gonna leave Jocko on the other side. Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe he was just one of those sort of annoying travel companions that they felt like they had to ditch. Like, okay, this next campaign, we got to get rid of Jocko. He is bringing the mood down, you guys.
That's right.
If he was just very high maintenance or something like that.
In my understanding, though, that would have the Jocko caricature was like, you know, a rather racist black caricature.
Correct.
So maybe
you think that's why they would have left him? I don't think during the Revolutionary War they really thought about it from that perspective. I don't know. That's also why I didn't mention it, because I didn't think it was relevant to.
Well, so they would have left him in the South.
No, they left him when they crossed the Delaware. They were going to New Jersey. Yeah, you know, or no, sorry. When they were crossing the Delaware,
but it still might have been there was still a large cultural difference between the northern states and the southern states. They didn't touch the issue of slavery, even though pretty much every state in the north was against it.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. During the Revolutionary War and writing the Constitution and all of that, because they knew they were not going to be able to get the South to join in if they tried to address slavery. So.
So was this was Jersey. Do we know if this if Jocko came from, say, like Mount Vernon, from George Washington's like personal camp, or was he more of related to the military somehow in the North?
I don't know enough about that.
I'm just curious.
Would be it's probably from Mount Vernon.
Okay, I mean, that's kind of what I was curious about. Like, was Jocko a slave to George Washington?
Yeah, probably.
It's very possible. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and that is, like, one of the terms, because lawn jockeys used to very much so primarily be painted as black and in very racist caricatures, and it's only been, like, more recently, it's like, oh, that's not appropriate. And they have repainted some of those as either white or, you know, I mean, you won't find the ones that would be what some of like the similar like minstrel show characters, same kind of falls into that type of racist folk art.
Right.
But that particular style of lawn jockey is called Jocko.
Right.
I was just going to ask, is
so
lawn
that would
jockey
make me
the term from... Yeah, from Jocko, the name, I wonder.
Right. So that would make me think that probably, especially if that has that connection to George Washington, that it would definitely have been a slave.
Right. Okay.
That I wonder why. That's so curious to me.
Yeah.
But I guess if it's to mind the horses, that was the reason, right? Was to take care of the horses?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that is, I guess, in the late 1700s, that is critical. I mean, that is
it's true.
It's important
having
your
car, especially in a war.
Yeah, but in Bedford Falls in 1930, in the early 1930s, not as important.
Yeah,
but I will say that it's an older home for them to have a hitching post of any kind, be it a lawn jockey or something else. That probably does speak to the fact that the home is probably pre-automobile.
Right. Right.
Definitely.
Makes sense.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Well, right. Again, if in 1928 they were throwing rocks at it and it was already abandoned, So, you know, it's not something that was just abandoned for a few years. It goes, it makes it sound as if it was, when they were discussing it, makes it sound as if it's something that's been abandoned for a very long time.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. It's,
you know, this is the haunted house, as you mentioned earlier in this episode, you know.
Yeah. I'm just so disappointed in the neighborhood kids for not breaking into that place and using it as a cool hideout or something like that. A fun clubhouse. It's just sitting there, you guys.
What do you mean? They were throwing rocks and breaking windows, you know.
They should hang out in there, though. I mean, it's very dangerous. Kids, don't hang out in condemned buildings, but it would be a pretty cool hideout, I think.
It's true. It's true. But maybe Mary didn't let anyone do it. Maybe Mary bought it when she was younger.
I feel like Mary has had her plans, and
yes,
nobody will sway her.
Mary has been manifesting this moment.
Yes, for sure.
Yes.
For sure. And then the scene changes and we see Bert the cop with some other guy who we don't know who he is. Even in the script, he's just known as Man.
Really? Okay. That was a question I had of like, are we supposed to know this guy?
What, the cop?
No, Bert the cop, no, we know.
The other guy.
Okay, I was going to say, is there Bert and Ernie?
No, this is not Ernie. This is not Ernie. Ernie's the butler that we get to see later.
Right? Okay. Yes.
This is some other character.
Right. Oh, this is the guy with the little cap with the turned up bill, right?
That's right.
They've got the posters and all this.
Yes. That's right. And so Bert and this guy have this conversation, and the guy goes, "Hey, this is the company's posters, and the company won't like this. You know, we don't really know what company it is, but it makes sense that whatever company it is, you know, they shouldn't be using these posters." And then Bert turns to him and goes, "How would you like to get a ticket next week? You got any romance in you?"
The love police have arrived.
That's right. And then
I was wondering if this police officer is the police officer on duty. I'm wondering, is he getting paid to do this?
Probably.
Or is this?
No, he's a good friend of them. He's a good friend of theirs. You know, so it's getting together. It's Bert and Ernie decided to get together and help out Mary. You know, that's what it comes down to.
Good is friends.
This
yeah.
Why Bert and Ernie were named Bert and Ernie and the Muppets?
No. The claim by Jim Henson is that it is not connected at all to the fact that the characters here are Bert and Ernie. That's his claim.
Okay.
I don't really believe it. Okay. I think it's too much of a coincidence. You know,
and I feel like Jim Henson would really like this movie. This would be right up his alley. So
it's amazing that we haven't seen It's a Wonderful Life starring Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy.
Correct. That we have not seen. But what we have seen is there is one there's an episode of Sesame Street where Bert and Ernie are walking by a TV screen where the names Bert and Ernie are mentioned. And the two of them just like look at each other. You know, it's like,
oh, okay.
But that's as close as Henson got to making
acknowledgement.
A reference. Yeah, that's right. To acknowledge it. And I love this guy's response to Bert. He goes, "Sure, I had it, but I got rid of it." You had romance, but you got rid of it. Okay. And then Bert says, "Liver pills. Who wants to see liver pills on their honeymoon?" So where is this company and what type of posters do they have? You have posters for liver pills?
I wonder if it's a pharmaceutical company.
Okay, but at the same time, he then says, what we want is romantic places, beautiful places, places George wants to go. So if it's a pharmaceutical company.
The whole town knows. Yeah, I just love that the whole town knows that George wants to leave, has always wanted to leave.
That's
and
right.
Explore, and has Mr. National Geographic and all this. Like, that's really cute to me, that they want to give him that, knowing that, yeah, all right, I mean, she just bought you a house, guy. Like, you're stuck here.
Well, I think right. What it is that George is willing to tell everybody, "I don't want to be here." He doesn't care that he's going to hurt someone's feelings or anything like that. "I don't want to be here. That's it. Let me
out." But at the same time, every time in this film that he has the opportunity to truly walk away, whether it's Potter offering him the opportunity to walk, the freedom to walk away, or the board in the beginning, you know, you name it, he's like, "No, this is important." And so really it's like, sure, he wants to get away, but deep down inside, he's his father's son.
Correct.
You think he's sabotaging himself?
I wouldn't say he's sabotaging himself.
I don't think sabotage. No.
I think he just realizes that his wants and needs are less important than what's really needed in Bedford Falls. That the other people around him, sure. He's not necessarily willing to acknowledge this, but that's what it is.
Yeah. He's an incredibly unselfish person.
Correct.
And you know, that's the admirable. I mean, and obviously this film is a perfect Capra-esque slice of mid-century modern life, as we talk about on Old Movie Time Machine, but, you know, kind of selling us that like small town life is where you can make a difference, making a difference with your family and your neighbors. And, you know, like you don't have to go and travel the world to be great. You can be great right in your own backyard, kind of like what Dorothy realizes at the end of Wizard of Oz.
Correct. That's right. There's no place like home.
You know, sure.
That's very
There's
true.
No place like home.
That's right.
Well, and it's interesting to think that this is still a time in history where most people probably don't leave, say, 20, 50-mile radius of where they were born. I mean, I think we're still kind of in that spot. Now, obviously, we get rail transport and shipping improves. You know, so it's the world is becoming smaller, but it's a transitional process.
Well, it's also because families stay close to one another and stuff like that. So you don't have very far to go. Yes. Like I still remember this when I was a senior in high school. So I had a physics teacher. So let's say I was 18. So he must've been in his late 20s at the time. You know, he was a relatively new teacher or whatever. And I remember him telling me, I grew up in Detroit or the suburbs of Detroit. And I remember he told me that he had never been outside of Michigan. And I was like, floored by that. And I said, wait a second, you know, I'm 18 years old. I've been to places outside of the country. I've been to other states, you know, I have relatives that live on the East Coast and stuff like that. You know, to me, it was just a very strange concept, but from his perspective, you know, all his whole family lived within a certain radius, you know, as Caroline just mentioned. And, you know, and this was in the early 90s. So we're talking 60 years after this takes place in the movie, but it makes sense though. You know, when people didn't have a reason to travel far, they didn't go.
The interesting thing is, though, that the you know, this is early in the 20th century, and the previous century, Manifest Destiny was a big deal in the 1800s. You know, we're talking about the expansion of
But that's until you found your homestead. Once you found your homestead, you didn't need to leave anymore. That was all. The idea was, okay, you don't have a place to go, so here we have this vast area that you can go and manifest destiny. But if you, once you, you know, any movie you see, when someone's, you know, has, you know, a farm in the middle of nowhere or a ranch in the middle of nowhere, you don't see them going anywhere. You know, that's it. I'm here. You know, I'm not moving forward anymore. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah. It's like an interesting generational thing where it was probably like what their grandparents or great grandparents that were like, you know, moving to a completely across the ocean to a different country and trying to make a life somewhere else. And then, you know, by the time you get to a couple generations later, they're like, I'm just going to stay in my hometown. It's so nice and cozy.
But you have to look at it also from the perspective that, I mean, we don't know enough about how the Baileys got to Bedford Falls and stuff like that, but it's very possible that the Baileys were some of the people who, you know, who started Bedford Falls. We don't know.
Right.
You know, it could be that the great grandfather of Bailey and the great grandfather of Potter started this little town named Bedford Falls, you know, and who knows? And that's why they all stayed there for numerous generations afterwards. You have to also remember this is upstate New York. So they didn't go that far.
Right.
You know,
sure.
Right. And so the conversation continues between Bert and this unnamed guy, you know, and as they're talking, we hear a whistle. And then we hear Ernie whistle to Bert, and he goes, "Hey, Bert, here he comes." And you see him like looking out the window. So this shows us that you know, I always believed up until I started doing research for this one right now that this was Ernie with Bert. And then I, you know, as I'm looking at it, I'm like, wait a second, there's three people there, not two. You know, and anything I did to try and find out who this was, you know, just didn't give me a name. I mean, there's too many people in this movie that are uncredited on IMDb. So it's hard to find out who they are because they don't really, they just might have a name And since they never mentioned this guy's name, there's no way of knowing who he is. And then
he's just man.
That's right. That's literally how he's listed in the script.
That's so funny. You couldn't give him a name.
That's right. It says Bert and Ernie are there with a man. That's right. What it says. It was very humorous the way that it says it. Here, I'll actually read what it says here. It goes, Bert and the man are putting up travel posters.
So strange. Why?
I mean, well, they only needed him for this one scene. So he served a very short purpose.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, the description in the script is quite interesting about, you know, when George shows up and it says, an old-fashioned rundown house, unpainted and warped by the weather. It once had class, but has not been lived in for years. This is the house that George and Mary will live in from now on. The rain is pouring down. A faint glow of light shines out from bottom windows. George hurries into scene. He stops to make sure it is the right number before going up the steps. You know?
Yes, he does seem rather mystified by it. You know, it takes him maybe a little bit longer, as you pointed out before, than it should for him to kind of put the pieces together of what is happening.
That's right.
But he gets there.
But he's had a very trying day anyway.
Yes, for sure.
You know, and then Bert edges on.
Act day.
Bert urges on the man and he goes, come on, we got to get this up. He's coming. Who? The groom, idiot. This is their honeymoon. Come on, get that ladder. What are they, ducks? Get that ladder up here. Yeah, all right.
The ducks joke is very a great example of period humor, I feel like. You know,
it's just a little farmyard humor.
Yeah.
Definitely. Especially since, hey guy, you're also standing outside in the rain, so are you a duck? You
know, it's that's
just
right.
a little silly, but
yeah. Then he goes, hurry up, and he goes, I'm hurrying.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting little conversation between the two of them, you know, showing, I think what they're trying to show here is that not only does George help others in town, but other people in town are helping George.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, you get the sense of unity.
Camaraderie.
Sure.
That's right.
These guys are great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all I have for this minute. Do you have either of you had anything else for this minute?
No, I think I'm excited for the next minute.
Oh, definitely. I just want to see the inside of this house.
That's tomorrow.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies. So because there are two of you, what I decided to do is we're going to do it in snake order, snake fashion. Okay, meaning that you guys can choose who's first. Okay, one of you will give your number five, the other one will give the number five. And then that person will give their four, you know, and move back and forth. All right. So,
okay. Well, I will cede the floor to my sister just because she's the boss. I just wanted to note that
wait a second. Are you guys sit brother and sister?
Lists.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We're siblings.
I did not know that.
Yeah. Well,
yeah, Justin, we have completely different last names now.
We do have different last names. That's true. But yeah, we're siblings. And we're also from Michigan, too.
Oh, cool. So
yeah, there you go. We're actually from Michigan.
We're in Michigan?
Yeah. We grew up in Livingston County.
Oh, sure. I know where Livingston is. Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
So I grew up in Southfield, if that helps.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. That's where I was born. Yeah.
You were born in Southfield?
So right. Yeah.
I was born in Southfield Hospital. Yeah.
Southfield has a hospital?
Our parents are from Livonia.
Wait a second. Southfield has a hospital?
It did in the early 80s, the apparently. Yeah.
Okay. I was living there then. So I don't know. Interesting. Okay.
But we did these lists separately. There may be some overlap.
That's fine. Overlap is good.
You have immaculate taste.
Overlap is good.
Okay. But Caroline, I think you should take it first.
All right. So Caroline, start with your number five.
I actually only have four because these are the four that I've seen.
Okay.
So
do you want me to do five first?
Yeah, you can go. If you have the actual number, I'm going to let you just give us a five.
Okay, Carolyn has ceded the floor back to me. I will take it. I wanted to start with something a little outside the box because Frank Capra did a lot of films during the war to support the war effort. So I feel like it's kind of important to acknowledge him. If we're going to acknowledge the artist and the sort of a great example of somebody who uses cinema for expressing sort of American ideals, that kind of thing. The flip side of that is that he also was something of a propagandist on behalf of the United States during the Second World War.
Who wasn't?
He did all of these. Well, exactly, right. That's just everybody got roped into it. Such were the times.
That's right.
So I was checking out some of his films from that era. I've chosen one called Two Down and One to Go. And this was released after VE Day, when the European theater was finally settled. But the Pacific theater still had to be dealt with. And so it's, look, this is not an incredible movie from a cinema point of view, but it's certainly interesting from a historical point of view, because the entire message that they're trying to relay to the audience, who would be members of the military still in service at this point, is that, hey guys, we understand that Europe has been won, but we're not done yet. Really sorry about that. We're going to have to send some of you over to the Pacific. And then they walk through the reasons why, using a lot of interesting animated maps, just kind of visually compelling ways to sell this idea to the military of we have to keep fighting and here's why. And they're very apologetic tonally of like, we understand everybody wants to go home, but we still got one more thing to do, you guys. And so I would say, you know, any of these are very interesting to watch, because he does chronicle kind of key moments throughout the war through his lens. But this one is in color. It's kind of interesting. It's hosted by the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson. He is not a host. He's not somebody who should be hosting anything. He shouldn't be hosting a brunch at his house. We probably could have used somebody. You know, Frank, you've got access to all of Golden Hollywood. Like, get somebody to do a voiceover for you. Let's sell this thing. But it's interesting, and I think, you know, people should at least be aware of it. So that's my number five. Two down and one to
Okay, go. So now move up to your number four, because it's Snake Fashion. So, you know, Caroline was theoretically only supposed to give her number five. So, no. No, it's okay. It's perfectly okay. Don't. I wasn't saying that despairing. Trust me, I've had guests that only had one. So you guys are both already in good company that you have four and five. So I'm fine with that. All right, Justin.
Okay. Number four. So Carol. Oh, it's me. Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, go with your fourth.
All right. So I'm going to go for number four. I'm going to go with It Happened One Night. I think this is a really interesting film. It sort of sets the template for every rom-com that came after it. Like, it really solidifies a lot of these ideas of two people, maybe opposite worlds meeting, and they don't like each other at first, but then, you know, the chemistry is inevitable and they come together. And it's also a very, because it's pre-code, it's sort of kind of sexy. It's sort of a sexy movie for, you know, the late 1930s. And Claudette Colbert and Clark Gable have legitimate chemistry. You can feel it.
Yeah.
So, I just think that's a pretty important movie.
Okay. All right, Caroline, what have you got for your number four?
So another James Stewart movie, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1939. You know, I just think it's a classic film that kind of captures, you know, politics of the time and some humor around politics of the time.
Okay, great. All right, so move up to your number three.
Okay, so no, my number three.
It's Caroline. It's Caroline's number three. Snake Fashion.
Okay.
Snake Fashion. You guys are familiar with Snake Fashion, I assume.
No.
I'm really bad at Snake Fashion. Okay. I'll work on this for next time.
Think of it as if you have two columns, so you have the number five, you go five, and then you move to the right, and then up, and then to the left, and up.
There. Okay. So my number three is It Happened One Night. I put that a little bit higher on my list. So same reasons. It's, you know, it's a great, there's great chemistry between the characters, and also really, I think, is that template for rom-coms.
Okay, cool.
Agreed. Okay. So
now it is your turn, Jeff.
Okay, we go to my okay. So I'll catch on. I'll get there. So my next one will be Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And I just find it to be an excellent representation of how government works, how idealism meets the machinery of government. It holds completely true today. It's identical. I mean, really, like, things haven't changed at all. This was probably the case, the Senate of ancient Rome, the same type of things were happening. But I think it is a very well-told story about the ideal man entering the fray of this already sort of pre-set up system of politics. And it addresses some issues, the Claude Rains character in this addresses this pretty directly. And he tells him at one point that I was just like you, I get it. And you're going to have to learn that compromise will get you, you might have to compromise on a big thing, but you'll get 1,000 little things to go with it.
Right.
Now he eventually sells him out, but it's a great performance by Claude Rains,
yes,
who I think doesn't get enough spotlight in the modern age, but he will always give you a sturdy performance. So, and as far as, this is a classic Jimmy Stewart performance as well.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Okay. All right, now, once again, it's you, Justin, number two.
Yes, I got it.
Sorry.
I'm going to go with It's a Wonderful Life, which rocketed up the charts now that I've seen it, because I really did enjoy this movie. I'm so happy to have enjoyed it. I'm sad in a way, mournful that I've spent years without it, but this is a very powerful, effective film and very well made with a lot of love, and we're here talking about it today. It's great.
Well, I mean, you say that you're sad that you never saw it. I'm actually envious of you that you've only seen it for the first time now that you get to see it with fresh eyes.
It was an amazing experience because so many cultural references suddenly fell into place for me. Things right. that are a part of the wallpaper of how we, how we exist as a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And to actually see where that comes from and have it like click in was such a gratifying experience.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
Last moon, and he's making violent love to me, mother, all of these things that Zuzu's petals were that are a part of just our cultural landscape. Now I get it. I know where it comes from and I feel better for it.
Very cool. All right, Carolyn, what have you
got for number two? My number two is the same. It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm feeling our number ones are also the same. But I have, again, this was not a movie we watched in childhood for whatever reason. I'm not quite sure. I'm sure we've watched it, I don't know, once in childhood, but it's one of my husband's favorite films, so it is something that we definitely watch every holiday season, and it's something that I've really as I have gotten older and my priorities in life have changed, I've certainly identified with different parts of this film, and sort of like the older I get, the more I'm like, there is no place like home.
Yeah.
So
okay, makes sense.
My number one is Arsenic and Old Lace, because, who doesn't love Cary Grant and a little bit of, murdering ants that are just so sweet and nice about it, and the stress that causes Cary Grant. So,
charge!
Yeah, it's a great movie. Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, and also having your sibling think that they're Teddy Roosevelt, so.
Did you have that issue also?
No, but I mean,
now that any of the Justin's your brother, so
yeah. I mean,
I thought
yet.
I was plenty of
time. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
And my number one is exactly the same. It's Arsenic and Old Lace. I don't know how we ended up here, but here we are. And for me, we grew up as big Halloween people. That was a big holiday for our family, and our neighborhood was very into the trick-or-treating and decorating the houses and everything. So this is just peak Halloween vibes. Mm-hmm. And and apex Cary Grant. And it's not maybe the most visually compelling movie just because it's based off of a stage play, I believe. So it kind of has that element to it of the one location, but everybody's so charming in it. It's really funny. It's also really creepy, and who doesn't love Peter Lorre showing up and knitting? So definitely this is one I bust out every year come October. I'm there for it.
Very cool.
It's great.
Excellent.
10 stars.
Wow. All right. So do you guys want to tell people where they can find you?
Our show is Old Movie Time Machine. It's available on all of the podcasting platforms. You can find us. We've got some look for the big blue logo, blue cover art. We also have all of our episodes up on YouTube as well, if that's where you prefer to get your stuff. And please follow us on Instagram at Time Machine Podcasts.
All right. Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot diggity
dog.
Love you truly, truly did. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.